Just 1% of public elementary school teachers in Illinois are black men, and for Latinos, that number is even lower.
I think it's very important for students of color to see they can be more than just basketball, football, rappers, or other trades where you see black males.
We'll talk to educators at UIC who are trying to change that by giving full rides to black or Latino students who study to become teachers. Plus, we're also talking to parents of kids with special needs who struggle to find a daycare facility willing to take their child.
We were only there for 2.5 weeks, and one day we picked her up and there was just a note in her cubby that said, "Darby's not welcome to come back."
And is your town home to the world's best librarian? Later, we'll tell you how to nominate them for the I Love My Librarian Award. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, childcare issues, especially finding the right fit for daycare, is tough for most parents. But what about if your child has special needs? The struggle for some Illinois families. Also, do you love your librarian? We'll tell you how to nominate him or her for a national award. But first, it's that time of year when students are already either back at school or getting ready to go back. And if you recall your time in the classroom, you probably remember wondering what your teacher was going to be like. Well, in the vast majority of classrooms, there's a huge need for more teachers who are black or Latino men, especially in elementary school. Just 1% of all public elementary school teachers in Illinois are black men. And for Latinos, that number is even lower. Research suggests that increasing those numbers can help boys of color not just develop, but succeed. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the dean of UIC's College of Education, along with a social worker and a current student about this issue. But first, we're joined by Nate Wall. He's a special education teacher at Yankee Ridge Elementary School in Urbana. He's been busy getting ready for the school year, so we spoke to him on the phone earlier. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
And thanks for making the time. I know teachers all over Illinois are getting ready for school. What's the beginning of the school year like for you?
It's looking real great. I'm excited. This is my first year at Yankee Ridge and can't wait to get it going.
Okay, great. And Nate, how many other African American teachers are there at the school, at your school?
There are two in addition to me.
Are they men or women?
They're both female.
And so I wonder how much you think it helps to have teachers look like the kids they're teaching, particularly when, as we have been talking about, there's so few black men and also Latino men who are public elementary school teachers.
I think that it's very important for students of color to see they can be more than just basketball, football, rappers, construction workers, or other trades where you see black males.
And when you say that it's important, do you feel like because the dominant images of black men that the kids see working are, for example, as professional athletes, to your point?
Yes, I think that it's important for them to see that they can be more than just athletes, that they can be doctors, lawyers, teachers, people of service, other than just people of entertainment.
And so I wonder, based on your experience, how long have you been teaching, Nate?
I've been teaching for the past 2.5 years.
I wonder what, based on your experience, what you can tell us about some of the challenges you think that young boys, and particularly we're thinking about African-American or black boys or Latino young men, what they face when they're first walking into Yankee Ridge and into your classroom. What do you think some of the challenges are that they have?
Poverty, addiction, not usually for their self, but they've been either born with addictions to substances. You're talking about homelessness. We're talking about different types of cultural barriers. As they navigate through life, they may not be able to really identify with the dominant culture.
Those are very tough things for adults to deal with, dealing with issues of homelessness or addiction, poverty. How much more important then is it for, particularly when we're talking about young children who are facing this, to have stable school environments with role models or adults that they trust, especially if they're going through these sorts of things that you're talking about?
What we know is that for anyone to succeed and to problem solve and to executively function, They need to feel safe. They need to feel loved. They need to feel connected and valued. And that's just at the root of any human. These students who are coming into my classroom, that is my primary concern. Do these students feel safe? Am I doing my job connecting with them? Am I showing them that they are valued and that they are loved? And once I do that, I have achieved a level where now we're able to talk about academics.
And what would you say? I'm sure there are people listening who would say, well, obviously it's not that white teachers don't love different students any less. I mean, why do you think race makes such a difference when we're talking about our teachers and kids?
Being a white teacher doesn't in any way put you at a disadvantage. And I don't want to come off as someone who's saying that if you're not a black educator, you can't amount to the same as black educators can amount to. You can see race. When I walk into a classroom and I see that there's somebody that looks like me, automatically I'm going to feel more connected or feel more comfortable just right away, just off top.
Nate, why did you decide to become a teacher?
When I was in third grade, I had a teacher. She was actually my third and fourth grade teacher. Her name was Shamim Raka. And she cared about the person. She taught me about leadership. She taught me about love. She taught me about Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. King. And I felt connected. I felt loved. I really just identified with her in the fact that we are both people of color. And I wanted to give that back. My mom was a teacher. I was adopted from Brazil. And she's white and I am black. So I think that the unity of love that she showed me, and that is one of the reasons why I wanted to become a teacher.
So I wonder what advice you might have to young men of color, and I'm thinking particularly of young black men who might be interested in becoming a teacher. What would you say to them?
I would say that if you choose to become a teacher, you are choosing to show black people that they can feel safe in school right away. You are showing black people that they can walk into school and see somebody that looks like them. You are choosing to invest in the future. It is the most rewarding and beautiful thing that I am doing right now, outside of being a parent, which comes first. But being a teacher is just that next step.
Nate, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and we've been talking about the need for more Latino and African American men in the classroom as teachers. Nationally, roughly half of all pre-K through 12 public school students are people of color, but just 2% of their teachers are African American men. An additional 2% are Latino men. The numbers were even lower in Illinois. According to the Chicago Tribune, there are about 575 black male public elementary school teachers and 465 Hispanic male teachers in the entire state of Illinois. University of Illinois Chicago has started a program with the goal of improving those numbers. UIC's College of Education Dean Alfred Tatum is on the line with us now, along with a student. Juwan Williams is a sophomore studying urban education at UIC. Dean Tatum, Juwan, thanks for being with me.
Wonderful. Thanks for having us.
How you doing today?
Hey, I'm good, thanks. We've also got Dante Lotz with us. He's a social worker at Wiley Elementary in Urbana. Hey, Dante, thanks for being with us as well.
No worries. How are you?
Good, thank you. Dean Tatum, can I start with you? We were just hearing Nate Wall speak a little bit about the students and families he serves in the Urbana area and what a difference it makes when there are more men of color in teaching positions. Does that line up with your own experience as an educator?
It does. One of the things, you know, when there's a sense of belonging and community membership, that can have an additional impact on both students who struggle and students who do not struggle. And so it definitely lines up with that. But more importantly, what I find with young students, if they have a teacher who looks like them, they don't carry the additional burden of trying to explain or negotiate their identity. And that gives them more affordances to focus on the academics. And they can accelerate, particularly if they have an excellent teacher who can move them to advanced levels of reading, writing, math, and science.
And Dante, for those students who struggle, you're just starting out this year at Wiley Elementary, but before that, I understand you worked for 10 years for the READY program. That's an alternative school in Champaign. I wanted to ask what difference you think having more men of color makes, especially at the READY program where you worked.
Well, first of all, I'm a huge fan of relationships. And so naturally, we as humans gravitate to those that look like us. It's just a preference that we have often. And so natural relationships tend to form through those means because we're looking first. The individuals at Ready are the same as at Wiley. We have a lot of young men that need those role models. They have missed that somewhere in life, and that's the mindset that we should be in as adults, that we have a lot of voids in our families, first and foremost. And like you mentioned, there are not a lot of men of color, especially African-American males, that are in the teaching profession, as well as specifically social work. When I came through in 2009 at the U of I, out of a class of 130 social workers, I was the only black male in that class. And so it is important that whether it's teaching, social work, or some component that's going to bring you into the school, that we are present. And also that schools are seeking out individuals that are qualified to be present and hire in their schools.
Dean Tatum, as Dante is talking about role models, when you spoke to the Chicago Tribune about this earlier in the summer, you said something that stood out. You used the phrase soul models, not just role models. What do you mean by that?
Well, role models can enter your life or for a brief period of time, and oftentimes that happens. Well, there'll be adults who come in to read for children. But young folks, particularly if we're going to shape positive life outcome trajectories, they need adults who are going to stay in their lives that they can rely on over a longer period of time. And so I was trying to make the distinction between a role model who comes in temporarily to make an appearance as compared to a soul model who are investing in a particular career to shape the trajectories of young men in society.
Jawan Williams, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. You're a sophomore at UIC studying urban education. Did you have any soul or role models that led you to this point?
Yes, ma'am. I actually had a few in my life, and that has been sort of the reason I wanted to go in the teaching field. One that I can think of particular, I was my junior year of high school, actually. I was kind of going through a tough time with stuff I was dealing with. And one teacher in particular, Mr. Braden, he always, you know, he was there for me. He looked out for me in more ways than I feel a normal teacher would. He helped me with things I was going through in my family life, and money-wise, I could go to him for anything. And that is a person who, to this day, I know I can still contact and still talk to, and a person who has really touched me and more than just a regular teacher aspect.
Mm. Dean Tatum, I wonder, as we're talking about all of this, we've been talking anecdotally, what does the research say about the link between having more men of color in the classroom and student development, especially when we're talking at the elementary school level?
Yeah, some of the current research really highlights the long-term impact or effects. And so, for example, having an effective African-American male or Latino male teacher in elementary grades can have an impact on high school graduation and college going rates. And that's not insignificant. That's the research that's just coming out of Johns Hopkins University. But also, there is a tendency to have higher academic performance, lower suspension rates. And if you're not in the classroom, you cannot succeed academically. And the presence of African-American Latino males lead to the reduction of those suspension rates or the time that young boys have outside of school, because there is a different level of kinship and relationship, as the two gentlemen on the phone just mentioned.
Mm. And we've been talking about how this helps young boys of color. How does this help all students, regardless of what race they are or gender they are, when they are seeing more men of color in teaching positions at the elementary school level? Dean Tatum, can I start with your thoughts on that?
It signals the importance of education, and that education is men's work. Young children are looking for cues, emotional cues, professional cues from both men and women. And if you have the absence of men, they only have these cues coming from women. And so that's why it's really important that both our young girls and our young boys see strong, effective educators in their lives who could support them in their intellectual development and their personal development.
Dante, do you have anything to add to that?
No, but what you, well, I'll say yes. What you're speaking about, in essence, is community. A lot of times we disconnect ourselves from issues depending on what part of town they're happening in or what school they're happening in. However, but it's important for us all to see each other as human beings and see the importance of why I should care about different cultures and different ethnicities, being comfortable in school and feeling safe, as someone alluded to earlier, because we're all one when it's at the end of the day. And so we have to see how we can elevate each individual student and empower each student to feel as though they belong and can be a positive asset to society.
We are going to take a break in a minute. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dean Tatum. We're speaking with Alfred Tatum. He's dean of the University of Illinois Chicago's College of Education. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a program that they've started that Juwan Williams is actually enrolled in as well. Juwan Williams is a sophomore at UIC. He said he's 19. He's studying urban education. We're also speaking with Dante Lotz, who's a social worker at Wiley Elementary School in the Champaign-Urbana area. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Nationally, roughly half of all pre-K through 12 public school students are people of color, but just 2% of their teachers are African-American men, and an additional 2% are Latino men. We're talking about a new program at UIC Chicago's College of Education that's trying to improve those numbers. Dean Alfred Tatum is with us, along with a student, Juwan Williams, is a sophomore who's studying urban education at UIC. Dante Lotz is also with us. He's a social worker at Wiley Elementary in Urbana. Dean Tatum, I wanted to ask you about this program that you brought to UIC. It's called Call Me Mister. This was first created by Clemson University. What does this program do to try to increase the number of Black and Latino male teachers?
Currently, we are going out to attract and recruit African-American and Latino males as part of a education cohort. And so we're starting with a cohort of six at UIC, because we have a responsibility to address the negligible percentage that you mentioned several times. And as a university, we're providing housing and tuition support, and then we connect these young men with the national network of Black and Latino teachers across the nation. So we're really excited about shaping the trajectory and addressing the teacher shortage and near absence of African-American Latino males. It's a long road to hoe, but this is our initial starting point.
Dean, what do you think? Dean Tatum, what do you think are some of the biggest barriers to having more men of color in the classroom? Is it financial? Is it the financial barriers that you mentioned? Is it mentoring?
I think if you see more male teachers, you can imagine yourself as a male teacher. So the near absence does not communicate that teaching is men's work to young men. So one, it's conceptual. Some of our most academically talented students are being recruited to all professions. And so they have a wide range of options. And so what we have to do as educators is to make sure that they view teaching as a viable option and let them know that they can become disciples of good in society by teaching. And the third thing that we find quite often, if many of our young men did not have wonderful educational experiences as elementary school children, then they do not view teaching as an option for them. And so it's a combination of factors that we have to figure out how to address if we're going to move the needle on how many of our young men enter the profession.
Juwan, how did you get connected with this program?
Hi, yes. So for me, I feel like my connection with the program was a little different. I reached out to Dean Tatum just to, because I've heard he was the Dean of Education at UIC. And I also heard he was a part of an organization that I became a part of my freshman year, Alpha Phi Alpha. And so I just thought it would be a great idea to reach out to him. And when he heard that I was an urban education major, he sort of just, he sort of just put me on to the program and brought it to light. And we went from there as far as the process.
Mm-hmm. And Dean Tatum, we heard a teacher that we talked to earlier in the hour, Nate Wall, talk about how he thinks as an African-American teacher, it's really important for him to see that for young, particularly young men of color, to see that there are role models and that there are routes for African-American men to be teachers, as opposed to what they kind of see in media, which to his mind, he said, were more athletic or in the fields of being a professional athlete or entertainment. You all, this Call Me Mister program kind of uses a sports recruiting model to go after these students. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. We recruit them to become educators. It's a drafting, a draft of sorts. And so I met many of these young men in their high school classrooms. I presented them with a potential scholarship opportunity in a very public forum, and they were excited. The same way that prep stars are recruited, we recruited and believe that teachers deserve that same type of attention. And as Juwan mentioned, it's just a matter of whetting the appetite. You know, when young students, both boys and girls, see strong men in professions, it whets their appetite, and that increases the likelihood that they may enter a particular profession. That's with teaching and all other professions.
Dante, I wonder, as we're talking about, you mentioned earlier you were the only African-American man in your social work class at University of Illinois. Whether we're talking about social work or teachers or anyone interacting with children at the elementary school level, what advice or words of encouragement would you want to provide to more young men to have them think about this as a profession?
Well, me personally, I would have to give my own testimony in regards to it being fulfilling. Is more than just a paycheck. I view myself as an educator and not a teacher, and that goes back to what was mentioned before, the longevity that need to take place when you're, quote-unquote, being a sole model or in a mentoring mentality, because that's what it takes. Like it was already alluded to, we're planting seeds right now in our young people. It starts right here in the elementary building, and helping them see that this is something that they can be. If this is on their mind, they can achieve it. Empowering them right now, and to continue empowering them when they get to the middle school, to the high school, and finally you're at the Call Me Mister, where you're being approached, and you have people along the way grooming you for opportunities just like this that are intentional and that are meaningful to our young men of color and to our community. So this sounds wonderful, and I'm hoping that it continues and also spread throughout our state, throughout the country, because these are intentional efforts that are needed, and we're late on it, but it's happening right now.
Juwan, what kind of teacher do you hope to be someday?
I hope to one day be a teacher. Yeah, sorry, my phone was on mute.
That's okay.
I hope to one day be a teacher who, basically like Mr. Braden was for me, a person who not only, you know, teaches, you know, helps my students succeed academically, but also in life, because at the end of the day, that's what we're preparing our students for. And the people we want to connect with. And so I just not only want to be a teacher, you know, who grades papers and, you know, gives tests, but a person who my students can relate to and come to about anything that they need in life, not just, you know, grades.
Thanks for sharing that with us. It's Juwan Williams. He's a sophomore at UIC majoring in urban education. I want to thank the dean of UIC's School of Education, Alfred Tatum, for taking the time to speak with us, along with Dante Lotz, who's a social worker at Wiley Elementary School in the Champaign-Urbana area. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
No worries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
More than two-thirds of child care providers in Illinois say they struggle to provide care for children with special needs. That's according to a recent statewide survey conducted by the University of Illinois. So where does that leave you if you're a parent of a child with a disability? We're going to talk about this now with a few folks. I'm joined on the line by Brandy O'Connor. She lives in Decatur with her son Mark, who's 10 and has cerebral palsy. Hi, Brandy. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to us this morning, Brandy. I appreciate it. In studio with me here also is Lee Gaines. She's the one who introduced us to Brandy. She's a reporter for the statewide collaboration reporting project, the Illinois Newsroom. She's been covering this issue. Hey, Lee, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And on the line from Chicago, from the Chicagoland area, is Faye Manister, who's a project director for the ARC of Illinois. They're an advocacy organization for children and adults with disabilities. Thanks for being with us too, Faye.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Brandy, can we start with you? Can you tell us about your son, Mark?
Yes. My son, Mark, is 10. He'll be 11 in December. He just started fifth grade this fall. He does have cerebral palsy. He is a quadriplegic. He is not paralyzed, but he does not have the typical movement of all four limbs. He is dependent for all of his care. He is tube fed, and he does receive meds during the day.
Mm. And you're a single mom, and so for the first 8 years of Mark's life, you were also his full-time caregiver. What does that involve?
Everything you can imagine. All care, bathing, feeding, changing his diaper, all movement. He does not bathe himself. I get him out of bed, give him a bath in the morning. I get him dressed. I put his shoes on. I put him in his wheelchair. And everywhere he goes, he has to be pushed.
Mm. And Brandy, I'm just thinking about, I wanted to ask you about what it was like when Mark got to kindergarten. It's probably a whole other story just about getting him ready for kindergarten. But what we wanted to talk about today was the child care provider aspect of this. And what was it like to try to find a child care provider for him after school once he started kindergarten?
Impossible. Mm. That's what I would say.
How many places did you try?
I can't remember exactly, a lot. I know I made a lot of phone calls, actually visiting probably only 5 or 6 facilities. I did take him to one facility that provided care 2 times. The second time upon arrival, I found him not properly strapped in his wheelchair, so of course he never went back.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Brandy O'Connor about her family story. Faye Manister is also with us. Faye, she's with ARC of Illinois. They're an advocacy organization for children and adults with disabilities. Faye, is Brandy's story pretty common for families who have children with disabilities?
Well, unfortunately, I'm very sad to say that it is extremely common. It's still, in 2018, it's still really, really difficult for children with special needs and teens and young adults with special needs to be accommodated and have their daily care needs met. In terms of children with special needs, we have children whose disabilities and medical conditions are already known and being dealt with by their family at the time that they're seeking child care. And then there's another group of children whose special needs become known in the child care setting because of social and emotional challenges and behavior concerns. And both groups of families call the programs of the Arc of Illinois on a regular basis, seeking help and seeking options. When children have behavioral and social emotional issues, that may be the first time that their special needs are recognized, and very often daycare centers want to the children to leave the care setting.
As we're talking about this challenge, when we're talking, this is a very broad umbrella when we're saying special needs and children with disabilities. Can you give us an example of what this ranges from?
Well, there are children who have asthma. There are children who have seizure disorders. There are children who have what we call low-incidence disabilities, meaning they're not that common, like cerebral palsy and Down syndrome or spina bifida. And then what we call high-incidence disabilities are ones that are more common, like ADHD, autism, cognitive impairments, behavioral health concerns.
So this is a big umbrella of different things. Lee, can I ask you, Lee Gaines is with us. She's a reporter for the Illinois Newsroom who's been reporting on this. You were reached out to try to find parents in this situation. And I understand there were lots of parents you found who were interested in speaking with you. What did you hear? We've heard Brandy's story. What did you hear from other folks?
Yeah, so there was a parent I met with in Springfield. Her name's Michelle McInerney, and she has a 4-year-old daughter named Darby. And Darby is diagnosed with ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and also oppositional defiant disorder. And what Michelle told me was that Darby started at a Montessori school when she was about 3 years old. And after a year, the Montessori school said, look, we just can't accommodate Darby's needs right now. And basically what would happen for Darby is if she was in loud or chaotic places, she would become really overwhelmed. And then she would sort of act out with her behavior to try and exit that situation. And so that caused problems for her at the Montessori school. So her mom told me that she kind of scrambled to find another place for her. She found another a licensed child care provider. They assured her that they could handle a child with ADHD because at that point, Darby had gotten her diagnosis. And she was there for 2.5 weeks. And basically what Michelle said is that it was a nightmare. You know, Darby was very unhappy. The staff at the school did not treat her nicely. And then after 2.5 weeks, they went and picked her up. And there was a note in her cubby that said, Darby is no longer welcome here.
Wow. Faye, what do parents in this situation do?
Well, the national research has shown that families have to make accommodations using what few resources may be available to them. Some families have to reduce the number of hours that they work. Some families have to stop working altogether. If there are two parents or two adults in the family, they may have to work on different shifts so that they don't have any, the child care is always covered.
Some families find
ways to work from home if their children are attending school.
Brandy, were
families
you...
Families have to think about supporting the whole family and also how to access health insurance for themselves and everybody in their family. So it's very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm. Brandy, were you able to, for the first 8 years, the first 2 years after kindergarten, were you able to work?
No, I didn't even attempt to try to find a job. I knew between no after-school care, the risk of him getting sick, and between having 9 doctors that are specialists, work was nearly impossible. I didn't even look for employment.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hear about a program that Brandy found, a grant-funded program called Kids Connection Indicator, the after-school care that she was able to find for Mark. And we're going to continue this conversation with Faye and Lee about families, child care, when they have children with disabilities or special needs. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Lee Gaines. She's with the statewide reporting collaboration, the Illinois Newsroom. She's been reporting on this issue of child care for families who have children with disabilities or special needs. We'll tweet out Lee's story if you haven't had a chance to read it yet. Brandi O'Connor, one of the subjects of her story, is with us. She's on the line from Decatur telling us about her family story. And Faye Manister is with us as well. She's the project director for the ARC of Illinois. That's an advocacy organization for children and adults with disabilities. Brandi, so you were telling us how hard it was until 2 years ago. You found a grant-funded program called Kids Connection in Decatur. How were you able to find this program?
Honestly, I don't remember how I found them exactly. I knew I was at a point where it was like, okay, it's time to look for help again. I need respite care. I need to start working. Something in our life needs to change. It's like I've been a full-time caregiver for 8 years. So I think I just got online and started looking at local organizations. It may have been through Facebook. Something led me to Macon Resources Incorporated here in Decatur, and I called and I saw that they had child services, and they said, you need to talk to Kids Connection. So I made the phone call out to that building to discuss after-school care.
And they provide after-school and summer care for children with disabilities. How has your life changed since then?
Well, I have been employed more than I haven't since my son started going to the after-school program. It's been fabulous. For him, it has become his socialization because he is not the typical child that runs around the neighborhood and has his neighborhood buddies to play with. His socialization is school and his after-school program and summer camp there. And it has opened up a lot of time for me to become my own person again, not just a caregiver.
Mm-hmm. Not just to become your own person, but to go back to work as well. Faye, are programs like Kids Connection common, or are they pretty tough to find?
Well, unfortunately, they're extremely difficult to find. And it's an enormous unmet need. Our state does have a Medicaid waiver called the Children's Support Waiver for children who have developmental disabilities, but there's a really, really long waiting list. There are 19,000 on the waiting list overall, and of the 19,000, 15,000 are children. And in other states, there are waiting lists, and sometimes I'm surprised to find that in other states their waiting lists are less than a year, but it's extremely long, and one of the benefits, if you would ever get selected, is funding to have a caregiver in your home. But I would say it continues to be one of the greatest and most challenging unmet needs.
Mm. Lee, what are the requirements when we look at child care providers across Illinois? How much training is required for licensing when it comes to special needs?
So when I heard Michelle McInerney's story, that's the woman from Springfield whose daughter was essentially kicked out of that DCFS licensed child care provider, I reached out to the Department of Child and Family Services, who license child care providers in preschools around the state. And I asked them about, you know, what are the training requirements? What do child care providers have to do? And basically what I was told is to look at the DCFS rules for child care providers. And I found that for home care providers and for licensed centers, that they were only required to have 6 hours of on-the-clock special needs training from a program that's approved by DCFS. And that's actually only the center director or the direct licensee. It does not require their staff to have that training. So that was pretty surprising. And I was also told by the spokesperson for DCFS that these are small operations. So they're having conversations with parents that may end up with saying, you know, look, we can't accommodate these children.
Hmm. And in the case of that family that you were talking about in Springfield, what ended up happening with them?
So they were lucky. They did find a child care provider that was willing to accommodate Darby's needs, which had to do a lot with providing her alternatives to, you know, circle time, or when some of the kids are doing this, she can be doing that. They give her sensory items as sort of a distraction for her to, like, fiddle with. And she's had a lot of success at this program. But the woman who's the director of it said, look, I'm not really that well trained in doing this. I just know that this is how you help kids with ADHD. She did say that she was not at all equipped to care for kids that have significant physical special needs.
Mm. As we are wrapping up this conversation, Faye, I was just wondering what you want people to know about what it's like to be a parent of a child with a disability, as well as from your personal story, as well as from your personal experience, as well as what you want people to know about this issue when it comes to child care.
Well, as Lee knows, I am a parent. My daughter is 37 years old, and she has multiple disabilities. And I was not able to get her into an after-school program until she was 7. And that was, that was enabled me to return to the workforce, not on quite a full-time basis. I had to work part-time until she was in high school, and she was able to stay in the after-school program where she was very successful because it was a child-centered program. And it also made me realize the difference between her early childhood special education program, which is what was available in those days, and the child care setting, was that she needed to go to the regular neighborhood elementary school, and I was able to achieve that. I wouldn't say that it was easy. And, of course, then when she turned 12 years old, I was told she was too old for the after-school program, so she couldn't participate any longer. And, I had to pay for this out of pocket. I wasn't eligible for a child care subsidy. And then I had to segue into working from home for the most part and limited in-office schedule. And, of course, I've been doing this for 25 years, so in those days it meant acquiring a fax machine with the paper on a spool and a pager. So we've come a long way, but it's been really difficult. And, over the years my daughter came on many business trips and attended many meetings with me, and she kind of thought that was fun, but it certainly was far from ideal. And although childcare accessibility is covered, and inclusion is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has specific mention and guidelines, for childcare programs, it's still an immense challenge for families, and it's a great concern. And true, we have the Family Medical Leave Act now, but however, if you work at an employer who's, has enough employees to enable you to take that, you don't get paid.
So it sounds like the legal landscape, right. So it sounds like, Faye, to your point, the legal landscape is just not there yet in terms of helping. Brandy, can I just end by asking what you want people to know what it's like to be a parent of a child with special needs?
I don't think people that live outside of, people that aren't friends or have a family member that has a child with special needs, they don't really understand the toll it takes on the parents. I know a lot of other mothers and fathers, you basically give up your own life to raise your child in all that means. You give up your work, you give up your socialization, you give up every penny you have because these kids are not cheap. And it's a lot. So having the child care available is amazing. And I don't think I don't know how else to sum that up, but for people from the outside, if they could really understand the depth of what we do for our kids,
Well, I think you summed that up very well. So thank you, Brandy, for sharing your story and taking time away from work to join us. That's Brandy O'Connor in Decatur, Faye Manister with ARC of Illinois in Frankfurt, Lee Gaines in studio with me here with the Illinois Newsroom. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're looking for a sci-fi novel recommendation? Maybe you need help searching microfilm for an old newspaper story, or you're writing your doctoral thesis and have a question about westward expansion. If you've ever asked your local librarian, you know they pretty much have the answer to almost everything. So for the librarians who you feel like are doing the best job, now through October, the American Library Association is taking your nominations for the I Love Librarians Award, which will honor 10 of the nation's top librarians. Jim Neal's with us now. He's former president of the ALA and also chair of the selection committee for the I Love My Librarian Award. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Good morning. What makes a good librarian?
A great librarian is one who really is focused on service, who understands their community, the needs of that community, and really brings their professional skills and capabilities to supporting whether it be a student, a faculty member, a member of the community. A great librarian also has great connections with other members in the community, with faculty, and with colleagues around the country, if not around the world. So librarians are smart, librarians are service-oriented, and librarians are well-connected. And I think that makes a huge difference in their ability to support their users.
What kind of librarians do you want to see nominated for this award? Any level, whether they're in a school or college or private or a public library?
This is a comprehensive award. It recognizes and celebrates librarians who work in universities and colleges, community colleges, who work in schools, who work in public libraries. The requirement is that an individual have a recognized, accredited master's degree, either in library science or one in school library media. And the unique aspect of this award is that it's not a peer award. It comes from the users in the community, someone who feels they've been especially well served by a member of the professional library staff at their local library. And I think that's what makes it unique and really quite special.
And what do librarians get besides the award if they win?
Well, the librarians obviously get great recognition. They also get a $5,000 award. They get a plaque, and they get a travel stipend to come to New York for the award ceremony in early December. So very often they come with colleagues and family members, and it becomes a very special opportunity to recognize them, but also to meet other great librarians from around the country who are getting the awards as well.
And where can people go to find out more information, Jim?
They can go to the ALA library website, I Love Libraries, and click on I Love My Librarian Award, and all the instructions are there in terms of how to submit a nomination. We will be accepting nominations through October 1st. We have a committee that's set up representing school, public, and academic libraries that will review those nominations, and we will announce the winners in early December at the award ceremony in New York.
All right. Well, let's get some Illinois librarians nominated. I noticed there were no Illinois winners last year, so let's have everyone in Illinois who's listening think about nominating one of their local librarians for this I Love My Librarian Award. I want to thank Jim Neal for being with me, past president of the American Library Association and chair of the selection committee for this award. Jim, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, I sat down recently with two students who were survivors of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Parkland, Florida, earlier this year. Here's one of them, Christy Ma.
On that day, we were hiding in the closet, and we had no idea what was going on. And so I just remembered, I wasn't crying at that time, but a lot of my friends were, because I was kind of in that survival mode. I didn't have time to be emotional. I was just like, I just have to get out of here. I just have to survive. I have to be quiet. And so I was trying to calm down my friends. So I was like, shh, you have to be quiet because this could endanger us. And once I got out, I just realized that I didn't even get to say I love you to my parents that day. And so I just was so grateful that I was able to go home that day and tell them that I love you and hug them.
Christy's starting college this week. Tune in tomorrow to the program to hear my conversation with her and another Marjorie Stoneman Douglas student, Nikita Nukala. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. It has our handles for Twitter. I always mention we're tweeting during the show. That's how you can follow along with us. You can search for our Facebook page to like us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, just head to our website, 21stshow.org, and it's got all of our information there, as well as past shows. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Thanks to Christine Herman for her help today, too. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.